From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today that Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore should step aside in light of allegations that he initiated a sexual encounter decades ago with a 14-year-old girl. McConnell told reporters he believes the women, who were quoted in last week's Washington Post story about Moore's past. Republican Senator Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania is among a number of other Republicans who agree that Moore should step aside. He spoke yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press.
From my point of view, I have to say I think the accusations have more credibility than the denial. I think it would be best if Roy would just step aside.
Roy Moore says he plans to file a lawsuit against the Washington Post in light of its reporting. Moore spoke on Saturday in his first public appearance since the claims against him surfaced, saying they are completely false.
To think that grown women would wait 40 years to come before, right before an election, to bring charges is absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
Why now?
Well, the special election in Alabama is now less than a month away, and joining us now is Brian Lyman, state government reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser. Brian, welcome back.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And on the national political front, fellow Republicans are putting pressure on Moore to step aside if the allegations against him are true. They're using that word, if. But in Alabama, it seems like he's getting a warmer reception. How are people reacting to all this?
It really depends on who you're talking to, probably to state the obvious there. The elected officials that we've spoken with have tended to circle their wagons around Moore. They've questioned the timing of the report. We've seen some county chairs even say that even if these allegations are true, they're going to still vote for him. But, you know, Governor Kay Ivey has been very cautious about these allegations. We have not yet heard anything official from the state Republican Party about this or from some key legislative leaders. And then you talk to Democratic county chairs, and they say that at least one of them I spoke with last week said, you know, their voters were already fired up for this race, and this is just more fuel for the fire for them.
And when you say that Governor Kay Ivey has been cautious, why? What is she saying?
She has said these allegations are serious, and if true, she's not been as outright dismissive of these allegations as some of the other voices that we've heard from the state this week. She was interviewed at a event last week where she seemed to suggest somebody asked her, you know, do you believe these accusers? And she said, why wouldn't I? So she's been cautious. We have two major legislative leaders, House Speaker Mac McCutcheon and Senate President Pro Tem Del Marsh, who endorsed Moore, but to this point have not said anything public about the Washington Post story.
And the governor has the power, if she wants, to move the election, which some Republicans have asked her to do. She says she's not going to do that or is not considering it.
That's right. She said over the weekend that she has no plans and is not considering doing that. That would probably be a move that would infuriate Moore's supporters in the state. I mean, we've just had primaries where the state voters chose their candidates for better or for worse. Moving the election at this point would certainly create a bomb in Alabama.
I just want to listen to a little more of what Roy Moore has been saying. He says he's not backing out of the race, and he gave an interview to Sean Hannity on Friday and again denied the claims against him. And Hannity asked Moore about the age difference between him and his accusers.
You do remember these girls. Would it be unusual for you as a 32-year-old guy to have dated a woman as young as 17? That'd be a, 15-year difference, or a girl 18. Do you remember dating girls that young at that time?
Not generally, no. If I did, I'm not going to dispute anything, but I don't remember anything like that.
Not generally, no. How are people responding to that?
That's the point where I think you see some reluctance from some Republicans in this state to go as far as some of their fellow colleagues have, because Moore in that interview denied the allegation, involving the 14-year-old, but he did acknowledge, knowing at least two of these other women. And as you heard in that clip, said he wasn't going to dispute anything. So I think that's probably the reason we're seeing some more silence from some Republicans than others.
What is Doug Jones, the Democrat in this race, saying at this point?
Last week, Jones released a statement where he said that Moore had to answer these charges, and the campaign, for the most part, has stuck with that. They're trying to talk more about things like health care and jobs and the economy. And, you know, Jones has Jones, until this weekend, pretty much had the airwaves to himself in terms of advertising and trying to make his case to Alabama voters. So, you know, he's simply been trying to talk about what he wants to talk about and, you know, let the stories themselves play out, you know, like as we see them playing out right now.
So what do you think is going to happen? We've seen a little bit of polling over the weekend, which shows now a very tight race in Alabama.
Yeah, it's very dangerous to make any predictions in Alabama, especially for a special election. I can say that structurally the race favors Moore. You know, this is still a deeply Republican state. At the same time, Moore tends to underperform in general elections, and there is real enthusiasm on the Democratic side. If that's enough to carry Jones over the top, we'll just have to wait and see. There's still a month of campaigning left to go.
That's Brian Lyman, state government reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, this week, families of nine of those killed in the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre in Newtown, Connecticut, nearly 5 years ago, will join one of the survivors of that shooting to ask the state Supreme Court to reinstate their lawsuit against Remington Arms, which made the Bushmaster AR-15 rifle used in the shooting. The case was dismissed by a lower court last year. Patrick Scahill of WNPR in Hartford joins us, and Patrick, as everyone there knows all too well, in 2012, the gunman killed 26 people, including 20 children. There is a federal law that protects gun manufacturers if their products are used in a crime, but the families say there's an exception in that law that makes Remington culpable. Remind us of both sides' arguments.
Sure. So the federal law that you're talking about, Robin, is the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. This is a law that passed Congress in 2005. And basically, it gives broad immunity to firearms manufacturers and dealers. But under the law, there is what the plaintiffs see here as an opening, and they're kind of centering their strategy around this. And this is a so-called negligent entrustment tort that's been around for quite some time, actually.
Which says that companies that know or should know that their weapons are likely to be used in a way that risks injury to others are culpable. And as the families are writing in an appeal, the company should have known they designed this for the armed forces, engineered to deliver maximum carnage. You know, these bodies were riddled with 13 bullets.
Yeah, and the sort of the unique, from a legal standpoint, the uniqueness of the argument here is that the plaintiffs are essentially broadening the scope of the so-called negligent entrustment tort. So as you say, generally this would apply in a case where a seller entrusts a weapon to another party, that party commits harm with that weapon, then, okay, the entrustor can be held responsible. So it's usually a point-of-sale issue. But in this case, they're actually broadening the scope to the manufacturer and saying that Remington, in this case, should be responsible because they were negligent in marketing this product.
Right. And the federal law allows litigation against a company that, again, should have known. And by the way, they are also including in their lawsuit the store where the
yes.
gunman's mother purchased the rifle. Look, the National Rifle Association wrote in an amicus brief that allowing the case to move forward will eviscerate gun companies' legal protections. What is Remington saying?
Well, they say that in Connecticut courts, and again, this case is in state court right now here in Connecticut, Connecticut courts never allowed the use of negligent entrustment to impose liability on a manufacturer for simply introducing a product into commerce. So in other words, Remington is basically saying, hey, we're not the seller, so because we're not, the negligent entrustment argument doesn't apply to us. And they're also pointing out, as you said, that the gun wasn't sold to the shooter in this case. It was sold to and legally purchased by his mother.
Yeah. As you mentioned, this is a state issue. How likely, what's the thinking, how likely is the Connecticut Supreme Court to take this up? And how would one state taking on this law impact the federal law?
Well, here in Connecticut, this case has been around for a while. In 2016, a lower court state judge did consider the case along with its novel negligent entrustment argument. And at the time, this was considered a victory by the plaintiffs, that this case was, in fact, heard by the court. Eventually, the state court did rule that federal law provides Remington immunity here. The case was thrown out. Plaintiffs appealed that. And tomorrow, there's going to be an argument here in state court on that issue. In terms of just sort of what broader implications might come out of this, plaintiffs say, well, this could basically open up the door to more challenges, of folks who manufacture these products. And if the case does move forward, it could get us to a phase of discovery where evidence interviews could be had with marketing people at Remington, and also marketing materials, internal communications could be accessed by the plaintiffs, which obviously would be available to the public and to future plaintiffs for other cases that could happen in the country.
Well, for instance, we have talked to the plaintiffs in the past and on other occasions, and they think, you know, restrict these arms to the people they were originally made for, the armed services. We'll follow this. Patrick Scahill with WNPR there in Connecticut as a trial or an appeal for a new trial gets underway. Patrick, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
The COP23 Climate Change Summit in Bonn, Germany enters its second week today, and on the agenda, a presentation by different coal, nuclear, and natural gas companies from the U.S., along with Trump administration officials, talking about the benefits of fossil fuels. But also over in a huge tent at the summit, U.S. governors and mayors telling participants the U.S. has not gone dark on climate change. The world's nations meet annually to talk about climate change. This is the 23rd meeting, and it comes as the U.N. tries to implement the 2015 Paris Agreement to reduce emissions and cut global warming, an agreement President Trump pulled the U.S. out of this past summer. The BBC's Matt McGraw is there in Bonn. And Matt, talk first about these two Americas on stage there. We know that here in the U.S., 7 in 10 Americans believe in the science of climate change, but we're seeing two sides there.
Yeah, in fact, actually, Rob, there's not just two sides. There's actually three sides here from the United States. There is the official U.S. negotiating team, which is still part of the process and will remain part of the process until 2020. They're pretty much keeping their heads down. Their main objective in life at the moment is not to incur the wrath of President Trump by saying too much or doing too much. So they're being pretty quiet. As you said, there is a whole host of U.S. governors. There were 5 U.S. Democratic senators here on Saturday as well, saying that we are still in, that's the name of their slogan essentially, that says that there are 14, 15 states that want to be part of the Paris Agreement. There are hundreds of cities, thousands of individuals and companies that are staying part of Paris, and they're willing to put their money where their mouth is. And then you have the third player who are likely to line up here a little later on, and they are a couple of White House advisors, an advisor to Vice President Pence and a climate advisor to President Trump, who are taking part or lending their weight and support to an event which will promote coal, clean coal as they call it, at a side event here, showing that fossil fuels have to be part of the solution. It's a controversial pitch at this particular conference, and I think it'll be met with, shall we say, a warm reception.
Well, talk about how the meetings are run. Always there's a designated nation this year. It's Fiji leading this. This is one of the many small island nations at risk of climbing sea levels and extreme weather. Fiji's chief negotiator paid sort of a backhanded compliment to the U.S. He said, well, I think we can perhaps negotiate with the U.S. You can have a dialogue even with somebody who is an axe murderer. What is the view of the U.S. and President Trump's saying he's withdrawing from the Paris Agreement just this past summer? What's the view there?
I think people have, you know, were worried initially when President Trump made his speech that some other countries would follow and that there would be a bit of an unraveling of the climate agreement. But I think that's not happened. In fact, the other two countries who were out in the cold with the United States, Nicaragua and Syria, have both rejoined the Paris Climate Pact in these intervening months. So I think most people here are happy that they're going to get on and move ahead with the agreement without the United States, if that's the way it's going to be. President Trump has spoken a number of times about renegotiating the deal. No one's quite sure what that means, but I don't think there's any real mood among the delegates in the countries here for renegotiation. They don't see it like that. President Trump sees the agreement as something that's been imposed on the United States. Most people here think it's something that's been agreed by all the parties, and every country has decided for itself what it can do under the Paris Agreement, including the United States. And so I think there are two very different views, whether you're in the White House or whether you're here in Germany.
Yeah. Well, so you've got the Paris Agreement to reduce global emissions. The Guardian quotes a diplomat with a great description saying the Paris Agreement is like having a brilliant new smartphone because it's got all the principles laid out. But right now there's no operating system. And part of what's happening there in Bonn is to, you know, hammer down the operating system. What are some of the sticking points?
Yeah, this is a situation that the negotiators didn't think they'd find themselves in, because when they signed the Paris Agreement in 2015, they felt it would take a number of years to ratify and get through all the different countries and all the different stages, and the agreement actually comes into force in 2020. The problem for the negotiators, though, is that everybody was so upset with the United States that they ran through ratification, and the deal is now operational and ratified by almost every country around. But the problem is we're still 3 years out from 2020 when it's supposed to start. So a lot of the poorer countries are saying, well, hang on a second, why don't you richer countries do some more now that you've got a little bit of extra time on your side? Why don't you go further in cutting your emissions? The richer countries here are saying, well, hang on a second, a deal is a deal. We're working from 2020. So there's an issue around that. There's also an issue around how do you measure, how do you verify, how do you report on what countries are doing on their emissions. And there's also the idea that by next year we should have a stock take, where global ambition is supposed to be looked at and seeing what countries are doing. We haven't really figured out how that's going to work as yet. Mm. They're not of themselves make or break, but they're the kind of nuts and bolts issues that could drag on and make things very difficult over the next couple of years.
Well, what about the idea of loss and damage, I guess it's called? This is the idea that developing nations, poorer countries, should be compensated for this horrendous destruction from weather that was caused by the richer countries, and they did little to cause it themselves. So this idea that they'd get some compensation, some of the richer countries balking, where are we there?
Yeah, that's an ongoing issue. There has been a number of bitter disputes about this over the last number of years. I think it's kind of parked at the moment because there was a kind of a commission set up on that to look into it. The key thing really is money. And I think, you know, richer countries don't want to fork out for years and years to come on this particular issue. Poorer countries do want to get some resolution of it. So I think there is some potential for compromise. It may be called insurance. It won't be called compensation. I think there's enough goodwill, if you like, at this moment in time to see if that will actually be an area where a compromise can be actually reached.
What's the mood there? Is there optimism? Part of climate change was that weather systems would be more frequent and more severe. And we just saw these, you know, the hurricanes that battered the Caribbean and the southern U.S. Is there a feeling of, you know, we can do this? We can actually stem climate change?
I think people are very concerned about that. I think we've seen a number of recent reports from scientists that actually indicate that time is very short in terms of cutting down emissions, and that actually the consequences of even the best efforts of the countries here are unlikely to keep temperatures from rising above the level that would cause serious problems for the world. So I think there's a lot of concern about that. The science is quite clear on that, and time is very short. So I think people are looking to try and push ahead with things, but I think they are tied up by the process now, and they need to work with the process, and they can't make it go any further. So I think there is some pressure to put countries on a better footing, to put the richer countries basically to ask them to do more. And I think that's really the thrust of where we are right now with this particular set of talk.
And with the U.S. stepping aside as leader, who's emerged? Who's leading this?
It's China is the real leader. China, the United States, European Union, and India. They're the big three.
That's the BBC's Matt McGraw in Bonn. Matt, thank you.
Okay.
Well, let's take a quick check now on Puerto Rico, where safe drinkable water is still hard to find nearly a month and a half after Hurricane Maria devastated that island. In an isolated pocket of the Central Mountains, which was among the worst hit areas, a team of seven soldiers from North Carolina's Fort Bragg is trying to help. Jay Price from Dewey UNC spent time with them.
Beside a lake surrounded by high limestone cliffs, a droning machine is slurping up the muddy water and rendering it clear and safe to drink. Sergeant Gary Wyckoff then directs it into three room-sized round storage bags that lie on the ground like giant beached jellyfish.
This bag's getting kind of low right now, so I'm just holding the pipe down so that way it doesn't suck into the bag.
While he switches valves on the 9,000-gallon storage system, other soldiers are filling all kinds of containers for a throng of locals that's nothing short of festive. Some brought 55-gallon drums, others empty 2-liter soft drink bottles, milk jugs, buckets. The line of cars and trucks is so big, police have to direct the traffic. Strictly speaking, Wyckoff and the other six young Fort Bragg soldiers here in the Utuado municipality are making clean water. But really what they're doing is creating a pocket of joy on an island where almost every one of the more than 3 million residents is suffering in one way or another.
God bless you, okay?
Jose Santiago, a rotund retiree, has rolled up in his red pickup, an American flag flying from one side, the Puerto Rican flag the other.
Oh, that's the powerboat. Powerball.
Yeah, $70 million. No, $700 million. That's what, to me. You give me money, okay, okay, I'll take it. When you give me water, I said, morning. Agua primero, échale la guagua.
Agua is primero. And here in Utuado, the soldiers have been making more and more water, more than 20,000 gallons a day now.
Who's coming to get it? Everybody. It's everybody from this area. They can't keep up with the need. They said there's 34,000 people there that still need help.
Utuado had heavy storm damage, with several residents killed and the homes of thousands more damaged. One community that's still cut off by road gets its supplies via a cable strung over a river. Not far behind the jovial Santiago and his red pickup is a dump truck with two plastic tanks in back that can hold 700 gallons. Driving is another beaming retiree. Three times a day, Perez Quiles fills the tanks and drives around his neighborhood of about 80 homes, distributing the water for free. And twice a day, his wife and sometimes a neighbor drives down with breakfast and dinner they cook for the soldiers.
They treat us like family here. And it's awesome. It feels like we're making a difference.
They are. Since the hurricane, most people in the region have been relying on water from streams, which carries dangerous levels of bacteria. A car is pulled off the road, and two couples are washing clothes as a pair of toddlers play in the water. Paula Bernicet, 19, is from the nearby town of Arecibo.
She lost everything. Her house was destroyed.
She says that she and neighbors come here to do laundry and get water to carry home for cleaning and running toilets. For drinking and cooking water, they go to the soldiers or sometimes find water somewhere else. She says it's unclear how long people here will have to piece together their water supply like this.
She's hearing rumors that it's going to take a while.
But an Army spokeswoman at the recovery center in San Juan says they won't be pulled out until they're no longer needed.
We're just going it by day and giving out as much water as we can give out to whoever wants it and whoever needs it.
And for now, that's more water and more people every day. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Utuado, Puerto Rico.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ziprecruiter.com/here.
President Trump is wrapping up his Asia trip today in the Philippines at the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, summit. Trump held one-on-one meetings with leaders, including Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, who's been condemned by human rights groups for a violent crackdown on drug dealers and users. Here was President Trump today.
We've had a great relationship. This has been very successful. We have many meetings today with many other leaders. The ASEAN conference has been handled beautifully by the president and the Philippines and your representatives. And I've really enjoyed being here.
Reporter Michael Sullivan joins us from Manila in the Philippines. And Michael, let's start with human rights. The White House says the topic came up briefly in a private conversation, but a spokesman for President Duterte contradicted that statement. What do we know?
We know that there are two different interpretations of what was said, but basically Duterte's spokesman said that human rights did not come up, as you said. But the White House said it did briefly in the context of how the Philippines is dealing with its own fight against illegal drugs. But mostly the conversation was about ISIS, illegal drugs, and trade, according to the White House.
And have human rights groups responded to that, that it may or may not have come up?
Their worst fears were realized, I think. They didn't think that it was going to be brought up, and it really wasn't.
What was the relationship like between President Trump and President Duterte in their meeting?
They like each other. I mean, they were joking. They were jovial. They were making fun of reporters at the meeting. I mean, these are two guys who like being right. They're two guys who are used to being right. And they're two guys who don't like being criticized. And so they recognize that about each other. This relationship, ever since Trump was elected, has been a good one. Duterte called him shortly after he was elected and congratulated him. Trump has invited Duterte to the White House. We'll see if that happens or not. But these are two guys who like each other, feel like they're on the same plane, and that's how that played out today, I think.
Did anything concrete come out of the meeting? I mean, have they made any plans to deal with terrorism or drugs or trade?
Nothing concrete that I've seen so far, but I will tell you that when the U.S. helped Duterte and his government in the siege of Marawi in the southern Philippines, that lasted for about 5 months, that ended just last month, that was a very positive development in the military relationship between the two countries that has always existed, but was put sort of a little bit on the back burner when Duterte was elected. Now I think it's coming more to the fore. And I also think that Duterte at this point, even though he's gone to China, recognizing that, China can give him some things he needs, mainly economic aid, that economic aid hasn't happened. And in the meantime, China continues its territorial expansion in the South China Sea at Vietnam's expense, at Malaysia's expense, and most importantly, at the Philippines' expense.
Did that issue come up?
That issue did not come up. That's one that both, I think, have been very careful to avoid this time around, because that's something that Duterte doesn't really want to do. He doesn't want to antagonize the Chinese just yet.
That's reporter Michael Sullivan in Manila in the Philippines. Michael, thank you.
You're quite welcome, Jeremy.
We want you to go, if you can, to hereandnow.org to see some incredible paintings. In one, a water bird floats upside down near a drawing of the botulism toxin that killed it. Another shows a massive factory, glowing yellow sky next to turquoise waters. In all, there are five large paintings and dozens of smaller ones by New York artist Alexis Rockman for a new show commissioned by the Grand Rapids Art Museum opening in January before traveling the country. These are ecological, historical, just plain amazing tales of the Great Lakes. Is that a giant squid? And what does this have to do with the movie The Life of Pi? We'll get to that, but Alexis Rockwell joins us now. So huge oils, but also watercolors, and some of the pieces include materials from the Great Lakes themselves?
They're exclusively made with those things. There's nothing else other than matte medium to hold it together. So part of what I've been doing for over 20 years is going to a place like, for instance, the Sleeping Bear Dunes in Lake Michigan, and grabbing some sand and putting in a Ziploc bag and making some notes about things that I have seen there, and think about how I wanted to portray Sleeping Bear Dunes using the sand itself as the material. No paint, no pigment, just sand. So I make this mixture with matte medium, which is just a type of, you know, acrylic paint without the pigment. And I make a drawing out of sand of, for instance, the Lake Huron locust. There's a wonderful tradition of using natural pigments from cave art through the earth artist of the 60s and 70s. So it's in that tradition.
You are there in Manhattan, Manhattan born. How did you get this tie to the Great Lakes?
Well, I have a fascination with ecology, and the Great Lakes are ground zero for the future in terms of fresh water. 20% of the earth's fresh water is there, and it has a fascinating and dark history in terms of invasive species and exploitation. So when Dana Friis Hansen, the Grand Rapids Art Museum, asked me what my dream project would be, I immediately thought of the Great Lakes.
Well, you had to immerse yourself. Talk a little bit about, you know, the research. Who'd you talk to? What'd you see?
What I did first was I read some books about the ecological history. And then I asked the staff at the Grand Rapids Art Museum to come up with an itinerary. I'd like to meet with people that have a relationship to the lakes, and that could be academic, historians, anthropologists, fishermen. And I made a sort of loop from Grand Rapids, which is on the east coast of the Mitten, as it's called, to the Upper Peninsula, where I had a key number of meetings with two wonderful professors at the Northern Michigan University, one Jill Leonard, who is an ichthyologist. In about 20 minutes, I had all five paintings sort of planned out. As you go across the lakes geographically from east to west, the ones like Erie and Ontario have had the worst problems, because not only are they the shallowest and have the least volume of water, they've been had the most exposure to humans. So what's going to happen to those lakes will eventually happen to Lake Superior if we don't really get ourselves together. We sat down and I made a series of rectangles and I said, all right, what are the big issues? I think the exploitation of resources. And she said, absolutely, but don't forget about mining and timber extraction and agriculture. So that became the painting cascade. the history of the fishing industry, the early Pleistocene glaciation. If you had a time machine and you went back 15,000 years, that would be an enormous ice sheet called the Laurentide Ice Sheet would be covering most of North America. And as the ice sheet melted, it left a glorified puddle. And the glorified puddle are the five Great Lakes. The plants and animals and fish that live in these lakes are, you know, they're newcomers in terms of ecology. They're very ecologically naive. So when the Erie Canal was opened up in the early 20th century, late 19th century, you started to see things that swam into the lakes from the Atlantic Ocean, like the sea lamprey, that decimated the fisheries. Mm. They're basically vampire tubes that have, you know, two eyes and they're a jawless fish.
Well, and that idea, sort of a tube with eyes, fits right into, well, you've called natural history psychedelia. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, the things that I've been attracted to over the years have been ideas about nature and life on this planet and geology. And scientists have been some of the greatest storytellers in terms of making sense of the world. But one of the things that's so exciting about being an artist is that you have an opportunity to make images, to create this sort of hybrid language that is natural history psychedelia. The history of life on this planet is psychedelic. It's almost hard to comprehend how exciting it is and how phantasmagorical things can be. The stories of extinction, of invasive species, some of the darker parts of human human legacy that have left not only humans doing things to humans, but humans doing to things to other life on this earth.
So how did she help you get to, you know, some of these huge paintings that I'm looking at? Here's one that looks like, well, there's an airplane. It's actually an airplane that crashed into Lake Michigan in 1950. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
What's that on the horizon?
There's a handful of boats that sort of walk you through the history of maritime travel, early Native American travel, the War of 1812, the early coal-burning vessels, and then you have a modern tanker on the right. So that's just a little bit of a timeline of boats on the Great Lakes.
We've reported quite a bit on invasive fish. You went out with a charter boat fisherman. You went to the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum, an abandoned copper mine.
Mm-hmm.
What did you personally take away from the people who live the lakes?
It's a unique place. I've done projects about Tasmania, Madagascar, Antarctica. The lakes are a fascinating legacy and really worthy of intense and enthusiastic study. So why not?
Well, beloved, you know, by those who live there.
And abused by people that live around it. There's such a confused relationship to fresh water, especially.
Well, how did you know how to paint, for instance, type E botulism?
That's right there on the internet. It's not that mysterious.
Oh, really?
It's a rod, rod bacteria.
But in other cases, we understand you had to call, for instance, Jill Leonard and say, do you have pictures of a sick fish? I mean, what does a sick fish look like?
There was a period where I was going to have mutated fish with two heads and stuff like that. But that just ended up being a little too cartoony and not as interesting as what was really going on. I ended up using some metaphors of monstrousness, especially in Forces of Change. If you look at that octopus-like monster in the foreground of the Buffalo River, I thought, you know, how do you show the powerful effects of not only geology, engineering, how do you show disease? I mean, disease is really this invisible thing. And so I thought, why not use the wonderful metaphor of monstrousness and monsters, which is a fascinating thing to me in Western culture.
So you have this octopus-like monster and then
the E. coli Kraken.
And then several little things.
Viruses and bacteria, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Again, hereandnow.org, you got to see these extraordinary pictures. Water is not new to you. You mentioned you've done other water pieces, but also you work with the director Ang Lee on the film Life of Pi. Again, this is a young man out on a boat. He's trapped with a tiger. How did your artwork help shape how that would look?
Well, I really didn't have much to add in terms of like the art direction or production design of an Indian city like Pondicherry, for instance. But I said, well, I have a lot of experience in ecosystems like mangrove swamps, and I know about the Sargasso Sea, even though I've never actually seen it myself, unfortunately. And I thought the island that Pi experiences is something I could really help with. The underwater sequence where Pi and the tiger, Richard Parker, come together and experience the world through a single vision, tiger vision, when they go to the bottom of the ocean and see this fantastic world, which wasn't in the script. I thought that was something I could really sink my teeth into and think about it in terms of, you know, some of the great cinematic moments from film history, like the Stargate sequence from 2001 or some of the evolutionary sequences from Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. So I thought about it in the context of film history and, you know, what could we do that had never been seen before?
Yeah. That's artist Alexis Rockman. What he did in The Life of Pi is phantasmagorical, and we'll post that scene at herenow.org. But Alexis, back to your collection at the Grand Rapids Art Museum in Michigan on the Great Lakes, also phantasmagorical, as we've been hearing, the paintings incorporate history, environmental issues, sand from one of the lakes. So the lakes are in the pieces. Are the lakes in you?
I have a tremendous fondness and affinity for the lakes, and you know, I think they've been pretty neglected by America. And you know, the freshwater issues that we're all going to face in the future, they're going to become crucial assets, more valuable than anything on Earth in the future.
That's Alexis Rockman. His exhibition, Alexis Rockman, The Great Lake Cycle, opens at the Grand Rapids Art Museum in Michigan in late January. Then it's going to travel the country for more, and again to see some of these pictures, go to hereandnow.org. Alexis, thank you.
The honor is mine.
This week, Republican lawmakers are pushing forward versions of a federal tax system overhaul. The Senate Tax Writing Committee is hammering out the details of its plan today, and the House may vote on a similar plan as soon as Thursday. Both would cut corporate and income taxes. They would also change the estate tax, or death tax, that is, the tax that's applied to inheritances of more than $5.5 million. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, how is the estate tax addressed in the House and Senate tax plans?
Right. There are two plans here, the House tax plan and the Senate tax plan. Both of them would cut the estate tax, but the House plan would go the furthest. It would actually end the estate tax within a decade. And the way that the tax works is important, as you alluded to. The estate tax is sometimes called, as you said, the death tax, but it doesn't really tax death. There are almost 3 million people in the U.S. who die each year, and 99.9% of them do not have an estate that is large enough to be taxed under current law. Only if you die with an estate worth more than $5.5 million for one individual or $11 million for two are you subject to this tax. And even then, it's a marginal tax. So if I die with an estate worth $5.6 million, only that $100,000 over the limit is taxed, which means my estate tax is, you know, like 3%. So I think it's important to understand that this is a tax on large estates, not a punishment for death.
And you write that the estate tax is kind of a microcosm of the larger economic debate going on in the U.S.
Absolutely. The estate tax is a Rorschach test. I think to its opponents, it is the ultimate punishment of success. It's an affront to the legacy that every individual wants to leave for his family or her children. But there are a lot of supporters who say, look, the United States has several virtues, like equality of opportunity, like the idea that inherited wealth should not be the predominant determinant of success in America. And so to them, the estate tax is a very important way for the U.S. tax system to value merit over privilege. But this is a debate that has absolutely split conservatives and liberals. You tend to find extreme varieties of these arguments on either side.
Well, why has it been so controversial? Because this tax has been around for a long time.
Oh, yeah. It's been around for more than a century. It's been around for as long as there's been a federal income tax, since 1916. And for a long time, it was debated and tweaked and so forth, but it was broadly accepted. It has collected about 1% of federal revenue since the 1960s, so it's totally thermostatic. But starting about 20 years ago, in the 1990s and 2000s, Republicans really started to make it a centerpiece of their economic platform. They really ramped up on the nicknaming of the estate tax as the death tax, which sounds much more scary. And a lot of conservative and free market institutions started producing reports that that claimed to show that it hurt entrepreneurship, that it was unfair to earn success. And so in the last essentially 17 years since the turn of the century, you really have had a consistent effort on the Republican side to make sure that every single tax law that they put forward either dramatically cuts or eliminates this estate tax.
We also hear a lot about farmers from the people who want to get rid of the estate tax. The National Economic Council director Gary Cohn spoke with CNBC's John Harwood about cutting the estate tax, and he said that would benefit farmers and small business owners who purposefully limit their growth to avoid the tax. And he framed the estate tax as a punishment for success. Here he is.
We do not believe that death should be a taxable event.
It's not about stimulating the economy?
It's both. We want that farmer to go out and buy the next piece of land and the next piece of land and the next piece of land and create the economies of scale and be able to compete in the world. That makes sense to me. We want the small business to go double the production line and not have to worry about the size of his factory, worrying that, oh my God, I may incur estate tax and my family's going to have to sell this business.
What do you make of that argument, Derek?
There are good conservative arguments against the estate tax. So, for example, like you can say it's a tax on thrift because you take two individuals and they both make $20 million. One spends it all on Lamborghinis and Fabergé eggs and they're left with no estate. And another person saves that $20 million for his kids and his grandkids, and he gets taxed. So that makes it a tax on thrift. And I understand that argument. But Gary Cohn is pushing an argument that just doesn't make any sense. First of all, he seems to be explicitly calling for the consolidation of farms in a country that's dealing with the problems of monopoly and market pressure already. So it's a bit of a bizarre argument there. Second, and far most importantly, this idea that the estate tax is destroying the lives of American farmers is an urban legend, or technically speaking, it is a rural legend. It is a rural legend, however, that conservatives have been making for a long time. However, in the early 2000s, the American Farm Bureau Federation was asked to look at this claim that the estate tax was bad for farmers. They couldn't name a single farm that had been lost to the estate tax, not one. This year, there are fewer than 100 farms in America that will owe any estate tax in the U.S., and they'll pay a total tax that's in the single digits. So this is really a canard that I think distracts us from the broader point, which is that there is a good reason to have a tax on inherited wealth to make sure that we have a quality of opportunity for people in the upper middle class, and below.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.